welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Tuesday, May 3rd, 2016. Students at Bahr al-Ghazal University called the vice chancellor and other top officials to step down after having no power or water for a week.
When we came here, the school administration was charging each and every student. We have been paying here school fees. We've been paying everything. Why are they not giving us this thing we are paying for in the form of service?
And Sudanese journalists say press freedom is a continuous struggle.
Sometimes you go to the field and you want to verify information. You go to the concerned or to the actualities where you can go and get ready information. But here, they don't give it to you.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Students in the University of Bahr al-Ghazal today held a peaceful demonstration to protest electricity and water shortages at their main campus in Wau. Hundreds of students blocked all roads leading to the institution's main campus and called for the resignation of the university's deputy vice chancellor for finance. School officials say the institution is facing a financial crisis, which makes it difficult to buy fuel to run the generators. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Wau.
Hundreds of University of Bahr al-Ghazal students chanted slogans demanding water and electricity as they protested at their main campus in Wau. Many carried banners saying, "We need water now and we need electricity now." Students' representative David Juma says students are outraged that they have not had electricity for the past week.
We are almost now 7 days. We don't have water, we don't have electricity, and we have been in darkness. So we are calling upon the school administration to make sure that they provide us with this, because students are reading. They cannot read in darkness. Students want to shower. They cannot bathe because the weather is hot. So we are calling upon the school administration to provide us with the water and electricity now. When we came here, the school administration was charging each and every student. We have been paying here school fees. We've been paying everything. Why are they not giving us this thing we are paying for in the form of service? So we need it in the form of service.
Asunta Musama, a first-year economics student, says their patience has run out. University administrators have done nothing to end the electricity blackouts and water shortages on campus.
We are striking mostly because of we are lacking water and power. These are our main two objectives of striking. We have cried several times, but we are not heard. So we decided to do this, at least, so that we can draw the attention of the government, maybe, and the public as whole.
Student John Akwek says he is demanding that the university fire Vice Chancellor Professor Samson Wasara and Deputy Vice Chancellor for Finance Abraham Matoch must step down.
So today enough is enough. We want Matoch to go. We want Wasara to go. They have failed our university. The quality of service have degraded in University of Bahr al-Ghazal.
Wasara admits the campus had no electricity last night. He says the generators could not run due to mechanical failure. The vice chancellor says the current economic crisis has made it difficult for the university to buy fuel to run the generators, which he says consumes 3 barrels of diesel per day.
The problem actually started yesterday at night, around 9:30, and it came out spontaneously. And before that, we have never received any delegation from students complaining about any issue, except before examinations when they had a team. We negotiated with them, and we knew actually whom we were talking to until the problem was solved. But this one is very spontaneous, and we don't know who are the leaders until now.
A lecturer in the College of Education who spoke on condition of anonymity because he is not authorized to speak to the media accuses some university employees of using the students to try to derail some reforms introduced by Vice Chancellor Wasara. He says last year, Wasara fired some university administrative employees because they were not qualified to carry out their work. He says Wasara set tough rules to regulate the management of university finances, which angered some of the staff. Wasara says despite the inconvenience over no power or water these past few days, he will continue to work to improve the quality of services at the university.
I don't know actually the attitude for all the staff, but I'm quite sure the majority of the staff are not actually disgruntled. This may be one or two, very few members of staff who may be actually agitating. Otherwise, since I came, I've never had any problem with the staff of the university such. This is actually what I can say about this. And I can't actually dispute what they're saying. There are people who may be disgruntled, who want to use the students, who want to instrumentalize the students to do things that they wish should happen. Otherwise, actually, I would keep to my policy as an academician until my term ends.
While State Governor Elias Wayanyipoch called on students to be patient as the university's administration addresses their complaints, he says beginning today, the state government will provide 50 barrels of fuel to the university to address the power shortage. Nyipoch also says the state government will drill water wells to end the water shortages. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Wau.
Teachers in Tambura County of Budwe State are threatening to not show up for work unless authorities pay them for a month of unpaid back salary. The teachers say they've not been paid for December, February, or March, but state finance ministry officials insist they paid teachers' salaries from December through February. Gift Friday has more for VOA from Juba.
In late January, unknown gunmen robbed education officials between the Jebio and Biki River along the Yambio Tombra Road. The robbers made off with 380,000 South Sudanese pounds, or about $20,000, money that was going to pay Tombra County teachers' December salaries. The teachers say it is not their fault the robbery occurred, and government must still pay teachers. The teachers say while January salaries were paid, teachers were not paid for working in February, March, and April. The teachers formed a committee to deal directly with the top leadership of the state as they await a response. Philbert Bapaite is a teacher at Seminar Primary School in Tombra County.
From December 2015 up to the end of this April, because we are now in May, they received only 1 month, which was only January. The 4 months old, they've never received any.
Bapaite says most teachers produce their own food, but still need their salaries to buy other essential commodities like soap and salt. He says unless the government pays the December salaries, teachers will have no choice other than taking off a whole month from work.
We decided to tell the local authority that if there will be no feedback for our salary over December 2015, we shall go also for 1 month to rest, to cultivate, to go to the garden, because we depend on our garden, which is feeding us for the 4 months. Because we are also the people having children in the school, we are using the same amount to pay our people to the school.
The inspector of primary schools in Tombra County, Angela Omar, says life has become very difficult for teachers in Tombra due to the delayed salaries.
And even to retire a bicycle for a teacher to go for his normal duties is a problem. Even a teacher cannot offer to get at least a pair of trousers, because a teacher who is receiving 300 and a pair of trousers is for 500, it is really a very big problem.
Omar says he is unable to travel to inspect the teacher's performance because he has neither received his salary for the last few months nor any transport allowance to enable him to move from one school to another. Tombra County Education Director Lelo Mark admits teachers are facing hardships. He says he has relayed their concerns to Budwe State authorities.
I forwarded the issue just last week to the commissioner, to the top authority of the county, who told me to be patient, to tell them to be patient, then a solution will be found.
Mark urged the teachers to remain calm and continue with what he describes as a national service, adding that the government is working to address the teachers' concerns. Budwe State Finance Minister Patrick Kandi says the ministry has paid salaries from December through February.
As far as the State Ministry of Finance is concerned, salary for December was paid, salary for January was paid, salary for February was paid. So if there is any technical error, I think the best person to help you is the Minister of Education.
Budwe State Education Minister Pierre Philip Michael blames the Tombra County Planning Authority for delay in paying February salaries.
The technical delay from Tombra County is based on the planning of the authority of Tombra County. I understand the problem is they are organizing a safe transportation to make sure that the money reaches correctly and in a safe environment.
Michael says his ministry has released February salaries to the accounts of all counties to pay teachers' salaries since last week. As for the stolen December salaries, Pierre blames it on what he calls a breakdown in procedures of channeling complaints. Most teachers in Tombra County receive an average of 300 South Sudanese pounds per month. Gift Friday for VOA News, Juba.
With the transitional government of national unity in place, development partners like the International Monetary Fund are looking to accelerate efforts to boost South Sudan's economy. The IMF says South Sudan needs a reliable partner who can lead efforts to fix the economy. John Mickelson, the chief of the South Sudan office for the Washington, D.C.-based IMF, says the formation of the transitional government of national unity should make it easier for them to offer fiscal solutions and advice that will bring economic stability.
South Sudan is coming out of a period where the conflict itself have generated a situation where oil revenue and oil production is much lower than what it was before the crisis, and also where there have been expenditures, particularly related to the security situation, that's been on the high side, been very expensive. And then, in addition to this, this oil price decline is sort of an external shock.
Mickelson is not celebrating the new transitional government of national unity just yet. He wants to be certain it is functional and its officials will be working in the best interest of the country. Mickelson says the IMF will continue to offer humanitarian support and financial advice, even in times of crisis. But a key element of continuing the IMF's commitment of giving the country financial aid is a government that will spend it wisely. Mickelson is quick to point out that repairing South Sudan's national economy will require a holistic approach.
It's not just financial support. It also will require some policy efforts, and particularly in the fiscal area, from the government to go along and support. And then finally, in order for the IMF to provide any financial support in the future, it would also require that others are doing the same, because the needs are substantial in order to stabilize the economy. So we would expect or would like to see that sufficient funds are also been provided by other development partners that are engaged in South Sudan.
Mickelson says the violence forced his office to work in a limited capacity where they focused almost exclusively on offering counsel to South Sudanese officials. He says while South Sudan will need financial support to ease adjustment efforts, the government must agree to make some major changes.
We would have to find ways to agree with the government on a number of efforts to reduce expenditures and increase revenue to stabilize the fiscal situation, where there's a very large fiscal deficit, and then increase in transparency in the expenditures, and also try to focus expenditures a little bit more on development and human needs rather than on security efforts.
The IMF withdrew their representatives and technical assistance advisors from Juba when the conflict broke out in late 2013. Mickelson says the IMF continued to provide advice, but progress was slow because the government shifted its primary focus to military efforts and fighting the rebels. He says in order for the IMF to resume a normal program and maximize their impact, there needs to be a good, reliable counterpart in the form of an operational government.
And that's what we hope that we'll get now with the whole idea with the peace agreement that was signed back in August last year was to exactly establish a more coherent government that was moving towards peace and economic development for the country as a whole. So that's what we are there now and ready to support.
Last week, USAID announced a donation of more than $86 million in additional humanitarian assistance to help conflict-affected people in South Sudan, as well as South Sudanese refugees in the region. Mickelson says South Sudan's economic crisis is strongly tied to its humanitarian crisis. He says fast-tracking humanitarian assistance will help stabilize South Sudan's economy. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. South Sudan still ranks toward the bottom of the list in this year's World Press Freedom Index. More on that when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what does your country need to do to be great?
I think my country needs to develop the sense of accountability, because in my country, people do things and they are not held accountable for their deeds, and no one even asks why.
We need to invest heavily into agriculture and processing of raw materials. That way, we will develop faster.
I think my country personally has the potential to reach great heights by embarking on their major sources of income like tourism, agriculture, and the great mining industry that we have. As we all know, Zambia is the largest producer of copper in Africa. And if they were to put up policies, Zambia would be a great country.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday health segment. Today, we are talking about training military doctors. The International Committee of the Red Cross in South Sudan is helping train doctors on how to treat war-wounded patients. ICRC officials say it is also important for military doctors in South Sudan to know international humanitarian law, which requires them to treat their enemies who are wounded during conflict. Michael Atit has more for VOA from WOW.
A round of hearty applause is heard after military doctors in WOW receive certificate at the end of a three-day training session. Vincent Taban, medical director for Raja County in the new Loli State, says the training educates military doctors on international medical ethics.
During the conflict, two parties have to pay due respect for the health facilities, for all the health workers. And also, we have, as the health workers, we have our mandate that we have to treat all cases with impartiality. We don't discriminate them based whether on ethnicity, religions, or any political affiliations or whatever.
Taban says his hospital treated hundreds of wounded soldiers during the conflict between Khartoum and the SPLA in the then Southern Sudan, because Raja was close to the front lines. Taban says during the training, he also learned that health facilities should be ready at all times to receive and treat injured soldiers and civilians. Manyang Dominic Deng is the SPLA's medical doctor in Winyik Military Hospital in Awil East, formerly Northern Baragazal State. Deng says, during the training, he learned that, though some sharing exercise, that doctors can learn a thing or two from their colleagues.
Yeah, we share our experiences and our challenges, especially during the recent crisis, how we were dealing with the wounded. So we benefit a lot. We share with them our experience, and they taught us also about the new way how to deal with this wound, gunshot wound. So we will take this knowledge to our people there, and we will train them so they will go and help people in the front.
During the more than 2 years of fighting in South Sudan, healthcare facilities in Malakal, Bantiu, and Bor were destroyed and often targeted on the basis of ethnicity. Karina Lehman is the head of the sub-delegation of ICRC in WOW. She says even though the South Sudan's leaders are entering to the new era of implementing the August peace deal, military medical personnel must still learn how to treat wounded people. According to the international humanitarian law, Lehman says, health facilities and workers must be respected at all times, including during conflict.
That means they must not be attacked, and they enjoy the privilege of being unhindered in their work.
Maclina Lino, a medical student of the Juba University who attended the training, says the information she received will help her medical career.
Now I have the experience. If I go to the lecture and the professor is talking and is telling me things, I already have a clue. So I'm like one step ahead of my journey.
Lehman says this is the fourth time the ICRC conducted training for military doctors in South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Wau.
A new survey finds overwhelming support among Africans for the media and their role as a watchdog against government corruption and abuse. The Pan-African Research Network, Afrobarometer, has released its findings today on World Press Freedom Day. VOA's Joe DeCapua reports.
The Afrobarometer survey is based on 54,000 interviews in 36 countries during 2014 and 2015. Africans were asked whether the media should have the right to publish any views and ideas without government control. Anthony Wafula is the nonpartisan network's communications coordinator for East Africa and is based in Nairobi.
We found that a majority of Africans, 54%, say the news media should have the right to publish any views and ideas without government control. But you also find that a strong 42% say government should have the right to prevent publications it considers harmful to society. The government should have some role to play in terms of what is being published as long as it is considered to be harmful.
But that raises the question, what is considered harmful?
Harmful is subject to various interpretations. In the past few years, some governments have been trying so hard to leverage on what the media is able to publish. So harmful here could mean anything that harms the interest of the society. Harmful could also mean things to do with probably certain aspects of moral values. Let's take the example of Uganda and the anti-gay bill, and that could be considered to be some harmful practices. Burundi could also be having its own definition of what harmful is, so it's a little bit vague.
Wafula says the survey also asked Africans whether the media should constantly investigate and report on government mistakes and corruption.
We actually established that more than two-thirds, that is 69% of Africans, say the news media should constantly investigate and report on government mistakes and corruption. And actually, this is the majority view in every surveyed country except Egypt, where 46% agree.
In addition, the Afrobarometer survey shows that 59% of Africans questioned say the news media are somewhat or very effective in revealing government mistakes and corruption. Some 32% disagree. 51% say the media rarely abuse their freedom by publishing lies, while 36% disagree. Wafula says this could be due to how they report stories and whether the stories are corroborated. Afrobarometer says that radio remains the most common news source. 7 in 10 Africans listen to radio. 47% of those who listen do so on a daily basis. But the survey says radio and newspapers are slowly losing ground, while TV and the internet are gaining. 1 in 5 Africans regularly get their news from social media. The internet and social media are more popular news sources than newspapers among youth and adults who have a post-secondary education. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
South Sudan ranks 140th out of the 180 countries on the 2016 World Press Freedom Index. South Sudanese journalists say working in the country is very challenging. Waki Simon Wudu has more for VOA from the capital, Juba.
A group of traditional dancers performed at an event today marking World Press Freedom Day in Juba. Journalists and others engaged in the media profession gathered to recognize the critical role reporters play in South Sudan and to shine a spotlight on the mistreatment of journalists. Philip Wani is a South Sudanese reporter with the United Nations Radio Miraya.
Sometimes you go to the field and you want to verify information. You go to the concerned or to the actualities where you can go and get ready information. But here, they don't give it to you. An official will not actually be transparent to you. He will require you to come with a written letter. You take it to his boss. And you know, a lot of bureaucratic procedures, which is not good.
Wani says just last week, when First Vice President Riek Machar arrived in Juba, some security operatives blocked some journalists from accessing the airport and the presidential palace, making it difficult to cover the story of Machar's arrival and subsequent swearing-in. Josephine Achiro, director of the Catholic Church-owned Radio Bakita, says that kind of behavior by government security agents is not unusual.
We face a lot of insecurity, and the issue of mobility is also one of the things. In most cases, this is one of the major problems we have because we are focusing in Juba. When you want to get information that journalists only focus in Juba, when you ask this question, they will just tell you, we can't access going outside Juba because of the mobility or the transportation and the insecurity even.
Achiro says some South Sudanese journalists have been physically attacked while others have received threatening messages on their phones. The Union of Journalists of South Sudan and the Association for Media Development in South Sudan are among the groups that organized today's event under the theme, Access to Information and Fundamental Freedoms, This is Your Right. South Sudan's Union of Journalists Chairman Oliver Modi says government security agents continue to harass, detain and arrest journalists. In the past year, 7 journalists were killed in South Sudan. Modi says no single suspect has been questioned in connection with any of the killings.
The challenges that are facing the media industry in the Republic of South Sudan, and particularly the journalists, is the recognition of the rights of the journalists to work in a free and fair environment. In the last 2 years, the journalists have been harassed, they have been arrested. That is an unnecessary arrest, of course, an arrest that is not being taken or carried in a legal procedure, and there has been some sort of intimidation.
Modi says government officials must abide by South Sudan's media laws when interacting with the journalists. In this year's World Press Freedom Index, as compiled by Reporters Without Borders, South Sudan dropped 15 positions to 140th out of 180 countries. It had been 125th out of 179 countries. Reporters Without Borders says the South Sudan government has restricted journalists from freely covering issues linked to the conflict. Eugen Owusu, Deputy Special Representative of the United Nations Secretary General in South Sudan, called on the government to improve its dealings with the media sector.
As this country moves on to bury its past and chart a new future, press freedom and access to information will be central to the quality of transitional justice, reconciliation, and the wider democratic reform agenda that we all seek to achieve.
Owusu is calling on the government to use the recently enacted media laws to improve the working environment for journalists across the country and demonstrate its willingness to support the media sector. He also reminds journalists to report the news accurately. For VOA, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
That's our show for this Tuesday. We leave you with the song Freedom by Emmy J. Yore.
It is time for South Sudan to rejoice.
We've been listening to Emmy J. Yore with the song Freedom I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.